It was almost a year ago now that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to Washington, came to the White House.
Welcome, Mr. Prime Minister.
For an elaborately staged state dinner that was part of a multi-year effort by the Biden administration to court him.
I've long believed that the relationship between the United States and India is one of the, will be one of the defining relationships of the 21st century.
This is an enormous priority for the United States.
Greg Miller is an investigative foreign correspondent for The Post.
And at this state dinner, they pulled out all the stops. They flew in a chef from California to preside over a vegetarian menu for the vegetarian Indian prime minister. There were lotus flowers on all of the tables on the South Lawn at the White House, which symbolize Modi's party in India. And there was a star-studded list of guests, including celebrities and many of Washington's most important players. And almost at the same time that this is happening in Washington, D.C., an officer in India's intelligence service is issuing kind of final instructions for an assassination plot against one of Modi's most vocal critics in the United States.
Did it affect my life? Yes.
That's Gurpatwant Singh Panoon, the target of this assassination attempt. Panoon is a Sikh activist and a lawyer. He's also a U.S. citizen who moved here from India for college in the 90s. We reached him in New York State and asked him about how things have changed for him since this attempt on his life last year.
I'm very careful in planning my day, where I go, how I go, and what public meetings and what public gatherings I attend.
And this feeling has been following Panoon.
Today or tomorrow, India is going to kill me.
Exclusive reporting for The Post has now uncovered the most explicit evidence to date showing that India's spy agency directed this attempted assassination. Greg and his colleagues, both in the U.S. and in India, have interviewed dozens of high-ranking officials, activists, and targets to uncover key details.
India has denied or tried to downplay any connection to this assassination plot. But our reporting really shows that India was very deeply involved in these operations, both in the United States and Canada.
This reporting is coming out as Modi campaigns across India, seeking a third consecutive term. He's made some incendiary speeches that reflect his brand of Hindu nationalism, a brand that sees Sikh activists like Panoon as enemies of the state.
This juxtaposition of these events, this assassination plot, this elaborate state dinner, this is a kind of a fundamental test for the United States and for the Biden administration. It's pitting professed American values, which have to do with human rights and the dignity of people and their safety, against strategic interests.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Elahe Izadi. It's Tuesday, April 30th. Today, how India tried to take out a dissident on U.S. soil. Greg shares his reporting and pulls back the layers to explain why this plot marks a stunning development of how India operates on the global stage. Greg, hearing you talk about this exclusive reporting from The Post, it's quite wild to me to unpack and understand what happened here. Can you take me through the beats of this failed assassination attempt in the United States last year? First of all, let's just start with, who was the target?
The target is a lawyer and a U.S. citizen. His name is Gurpatwant Singh Panoon.
I'm the general counsel to human rights advocacy group Sikhs for Justice.
He is a Sikh activist. He is an activist on behalf of a cause of creating a separate Sikh state in northern India.
To get their separate religious identity recognized by India.
So then what were the details of this plan? How did this all come together?
So the plot is set in motion in May of 2023. when the Indian Intelligence Service hires an alleged middleman, whose name is Nikhil Gupta, to help them hire an assassin in the United States. Gupta is, according to U.S. criminal filings, an accused Indian drug and weapons trafficker, someone who has done some work with the Indian intelligence officers in the past. They see Gupta as somebody who can help them find an assassin to kill Panoon in the United States. Gupta, in turn, makes contact with somebody he believes is a drug and weapons trafficker already in the United States, according to the U.S. charges in this case. That's not exactly who this individual is. It turns out that the person Gupta's been in touch with is secretly an informant for the Drug Enforcement Agency in the United States. So this plot has a problem from the very outset. The Indian government doesn't realize this at the time. It only becomes clear later on.
So wait, the U.S., from your telling, it sounds like they are in on what's brewing here, that someone has planned a hit of someone on U.S. soil. So when did the U.S. government realize the extent of this assassination plot?
So as this is unfolding in June, it takes a while for the United States to piece this together. It does not happen while Modi is at Washington. It does not happen while he's at the state dinner. In fact, at that point, the United States sees this as a weird drug criminal case, as somebody trying to arrange a hit in New York in connection with the operations of some criminal syndicate. They don't necessarily see at that time that this is in fact an operation being spearheaded by the Indian Intelligence Service. That's not something they really, really understand until Gupta's in custody, they have his devices, and they have a lot more evidence showing that he is doing the bidding of the Indian spy service.
So, Greg, you had mentioned the Indian Intelligence Service. Can you tell me more about what that looks like? Who is that and what do they do?
So the Research and Analysis Wing is India's main foreign intelligence service, their equivalent of the CIA. Reputationally, it hasn't been very well thought of for a long time. I mean, not a player in Europe or the United States or North America. Under Modi, that's kind of changed. They've gotten more resources, become more aggressive, and been kind of deployed as a weapon against the Indian diaspora, including and especially against Sikh activists and Sikh extremists around the world.
And so then, Greg, can you talk me through how you and your colleagues have been able to verify that this is what took place?
Yeah. So, you know, for starters, there is a criminal case here. The middleman, Nikhil Gupta, has been charged with being part of this murder for hire conspiracy. The bigger questions surrounding this have been all along, how high does this go in the Indian government? And so that's where we have focused all of our reporting. What we did was through interviews with current and former officials in India, in the United States, and in other countries, worked to identify who was working with this middleman and who, within the Indian government, in Modi's inner circle, was connected to these operations.
So how high did this go? Who did know?
That's a question that I think U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies are grappling with even now. And the answer is complicated. There is evidence, direct evidence, that an officer in India's intelligence agency was responsible for orchestrating this assassination plot in the United States. He's not named in the U.S. indictment. He's referred to only as a co-conspirator. We were able to, through sourcing and interviews, identify that co-conspirator as Vikram Yadav. So you have this mid-level intelligence officer in India's spy service directing this operation from India. How high it goes beyond him gets more murky. U.S. intelligence analysts looking at this plot, they have assessed that the head of the Indian intelligence service authorized these operations. This was somebody named Sumant Goel. He was the head of India's spy agency at the time. U.S. spy agencies have assessed more tentatively, with slightly less confidence, that Modi's national security advisor, Ajit Doval, also likely knew about these operations, at least the idea that India's spy agency was going to be pursuing and trying to kill Sikh activists outside India. We tried to reach Doval and Goel for this story, called them repeatedly, sent messages to them repeatedly, got no response. We asked the Indian government to reach them, and they never responded to any of our requests. The trick is, the United States, the officials that we've talked to, acknowledge that they don't have smoking gun proof of their direct complicity in this plot. These are analytic assessments that U.S. agencies have reached based on their understanding of this plot, how the Indian system works, and the extraordinary unlikelihood that mid-level people within the Indian intelligence service would advance a plot with so many risks without cover from the very top. And by the way, we also, in India, spoke with current and former officials of that government and of the Indian intelligence services who are aware of this plot, have direct knowledge of this operation, this assassination attempt. And they confirm everything that we've learned from the sources that we've talked to in Western governments, including the United States.
I have a lot of questions about the United States government's involvement and knowledge about this, but I want, before I get to that, I am curious, if we were to just step back and think about targeting dissidents abroad, this is something that I've heard just, you know, by reading the news and paying attention to what our colleagues report that other governments do. I'm aware of, you know, those sorts of attempts by Russia and Iran and other countries. Is this an escalation on the part of India? Is this in the norm, or does this signal something distinct or new about the Modi government?
I think that this is an alarming escalation, and it tells us something very significant about the Modi government. Now, India, for many years, has been accused of, suspected of, carrying out lethal operations, kidnappings in and around India, especially on the border regions of India and Pakistan. The idea of India launching an assassination plot, not only in a Western government, but in the United States, I think that's what has stunned Western security officials more than anything else here.
Mm-hmm. I did want to understand more about why Modi's government in particular would be targeting Sikhs at home and also globally and in Canada and the United States. What's at the root of that?
So I would say there are a few things there. One is that this reflects a mindset that took root in the 1980s when there was a great deal of violence in northern India. Many thousands of people were killed in insurgencies and in crackdowns by the Indian government against Sikhs who at the time were trying to establish a separate state, much the way that Pakistan was partitioned and became a Muslim state. There were huge events during this period. The Indian government stormed and took over the most holy site in the Sikh religion at one point. And Sikh militants responded with the assassination of Indira Gandhi, the prime minister at the time, with the downing of an Air Canada flight within a few months after that. So this was an intense, intense fight. Where it stands now is, you know, that Sikh nationalist movement has largely dissipated. There really is no meaningful threat in India of having Sikhs establish a separate state or carving off a big chunk of India for themselves. But Modi and many of the members of his inner circle sort of came of age during that time. Their experiences and their understanding of threats to India are defined by their experiences from that era. So they still sort of have what many Western people I've talked to describe as a disproportionate, almost obsession with Sikh activists. They just can't let go of this.
I have been designated as a terrorist by the Indian government from 2019 and 2020. They declared Sikhs for Justice as an unlawful organization. They have issued a reward on my head. So this, what was happening in June or what happened a year before that or what is happening right now is not a surprise to me.
But there's another factor here as well, and it's probably just as important. It's a political one. Modi, of course, came to power carrying the sort of flag of Hindu nationalism, that Hindus have a special place in India, that followers of the Hindu religion, the dominant religion in India, are its most important people. And so there is political advantage for Modi to kind of demonize followers of other faiths and to cast himself as the protector of the 80% of India that is Hindu.
You know, it's interesting, Greg, because I feel like especially in recent weeks, as there's an election in India, there has been attention on some of the rhetoric that Modi has, especially around Muslims in the country. And this reporting around how Sikh activists have been targeted, it's raising that thread of it for me. And it also reminds me of the news that came out, and I believe it was also last summer, of the shooting death of a Sikh activist in Canada and questions around Modi's government's involvement in that. Can you just remind us of what happened there?
Yeah, so just almost at the same time that Modi's at the White House, at the same time that this assassination plot is unfolding in the United States, a separate Indian assassination plot also carried out by the Indian Intelligence Service is happening in Canada near Vancouver, where one of the largest Sikh populations in the world exists outside India. A Canadian named Hardeep Singh Nijjar was killed, gunned down, shot dozens of times as he was driving away from a Sikh temple in British Columbia.
Over the past number of weeks, Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
That's the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. And he's stepping forward and essentially accusing India of being complicit in that plot. He's pinning this on the Indian government in a very public way.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open, and democratic societies conduct themselves.
The Canadians go on to expel the top-ranking Indian intelligence officer from Canada. This is a very direct confrontation between the Canadian government and the Indian government over an assassination that happens in Canada. And what the Prime Minister is saying there is like a really fundamental point. He's talking about this is a violation of Canadian sovereignty. This is a country of laws. There are ways that countries are supposed to interact with one another. Sending hit teams into other countries is not how any of this is supposed to work in the global order.
Greg, what has the Indian government said in response to these revelations of this attempted assassination in the United States and also what Justin Trudeau has said?
Almost nothing. Modi has been asked about it only once or twice and has been very dismissive and has basically said, well, if anybody can show us that we did something wrong, of course, we'll look into this. We're a nation of laws. We want to follow the rule of law. That's what matters to us. And the Indian government in private with U.S. and Canadian officials has been at times defiant and saying, look, you guys are at fault here. You're the ones who are sheltering people we consider terrorists. And then as this crisis sort of progressed, kind of changed tone a tiny bit and said, okay, fine, we'll do our own internal investigation. You tell us what you have. Let us know everything you know. And we'll look into this and we'll get back to you. And that's kind of where things stand now.
They know that there will not be any consequence if they come and shoot Pannu down. Means nobody will care, even if they would have killed me. You know, what would have been the consequences, except for my campaign? Is U.S. going to stop trading with India? Is U.S. is going to put some sanctions against India?
After the break, why the Biden administration isn't hitting back harder against India for trying to assassinate a U.S. citizen on American soil. We'll be right back.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
I want to go back to this particular failed assassination attempt and how it was foiled. And in your telling of it, it was an agent of the DEA, you know, the U.S. government essentially stopped it, is what it sounds like. And so I'm trying to understand, where does the United States stand within this? Because on the one hand, they are actively, it sounds like, you know, maybe covertly trying to thwart these attempts on a U.S. citizen. But on the other hand, I haven't heard the sort of tough talk from President Biden that maybe I heard in that statement from Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister.
You're exactly right. The United States approach has been very different from the Canadian approach. The United States has tried to contain this crisis, has focused on avoiding a bigger rupture with India. India is too important to the United States strategically to burn up the whole relationship over a failed assassination plot, as bad and as this was and as frightening as this was. So the United States has been trying to prod India behind the scenes, but hasn't done anything so far to punish India, hasn't expelled any Indian intelligence officers, hasn't put any financial sanctions on Indian government officials, has taken no steps to penalize the Indian government, at least not yet.
Can you say more about why they appear to be holding back? What is it about this relationship that makes it so important that the U.S. government wouldn't be willing to risk torpedoing it completely over this?
So there's a longer answer and there's a shorter answer. The shorter answer is so short, it's just one word, and it's China. It is concern about this dawning era of global competition in which Western governments are very concerned about competing with China, about what China's intentions are, what China's capabilities are. And so the United States and other U.S. allies see India as an important democratic partner in this competition with China. And they don't want to push India away. They want India to remain on the side of democracy. If anything, they would like to draw India closer into Western relationships and Western cooperation. And so that is really what's driving the United States calculations in terms of how to respond to this assassination.
Are they operating anymore as a democracy as we would think of it?
Yeah, no, I think that people increasingly talk about India. There's all these new terms that come up, right? So we're talking about transnational repression here, which is the broader framework for our story, where countries pursue their adversaries in other sovereign territory. But India, I think a lot of experts now talk of it as a hybrid democracy, no longer as an inclusive democracy, right? You have lots of questions about the fairness of the elections that are underway right now. In Modi's tenure, a great deal of new troubling authoritarianism. India has become stronger economically, has a lot more clout, but is far, far more authoritarian. Journalists get jailed. News organizations are expected to kind of support Modi and his party or pay the price. And activists, critics, you know, this is a government that will take extraordinary steps to silence them.
India is following the footsteps of the authoritarian regimes, and they have proved it that they are willing to kill U.S. citizens on U.S. soil for their activism, for having a dissenting political opinion.
Even though this assassination, this plot was botched, It just sort of exposed terrible tradecraft on the part of India's intelligence service. In some ways, it will have accomplished what it was intended to accomplish, which is to make Sikh activists look over their shoulder, Sikh activists wonder, could I be next? Am I safe? Should I be doing what I'm doing? And basically, this has a chilling effect on anybody who is critical of the Modi government. In many ways, this has played to Modi's political advantage. We talked about how an election in India is underway. Modi is widely expected to be headed toward a huge triumph, a huge victory, a very comfortable victory. At a very, very recent campaign event, Modi literally talked about how this is a new India. This is a stronger India. We are now tough guys.
Ye naya Bharat ghar mein ghuskar marta hai.
Modi, in his own words, says, this new India comes into your home to kill you. They're not apologizing for any of these operations. To the contrary, his status as a strong man has only been strengthened by the idea that he and his government are willing to do things that other governments in India's history did not.
And so what has happened to the people who U.S. officials allege were behind orchestrating this assassination attempt in the United States? Do we know what's happened to them and where are they?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, there are two important players here. You have this Indian intelligence officer named Vikram Yadav. He's the person behind this. He's the one who's in control of it from India. But as soon as this whole plot unravels, he kind of disappears. Then there's Nikhil Gupta, and he was the middleman who was enlisted to help find an assassin in the United States. So Gupta remains, even now, the only person publicly that we know of who's been charged with a crime in association with this entire assassination scheme. His lawyer, whom we spoke with for the story, insists that his client is innocent. His family insists that he is innocent, not guilty of this crime, and that this is all a case of a mistaken identity.
And then, Greg, I can imagine, given this sort of balancing act that the Biden administration, the U.S. government is trying to walk in regards to its relationship with India, that now that this reporting is coming out and it's public and you and your colleagues have uncovered it, what has the administration said to you about it? And is this throwing a wrench and complicating, you know, do they not want this to become public?
You know, something happened in this story that was a little strange to me as we came closer to publication. And it kind of gave us an additional sense of just how nervous the White House has been about this and how concerned the White House is about the potential to harm the relationship with India. Just within the last several days, we learned that the White House had actually warned the Indian government that the Washington Post was close to publishing some important new revelations about this case, including identifying the Indian intelligence officer who was directly connected to the assassination plot. I haven't had that happen that I know of in my career, in many, many years of covering national security, both in Washington and overseas. For the White House to give the Modi government a heads up was concerning to some of us at the Post, but it tells you how concerned the White House is about protecting that relationship.
Wow. And then just looking ahead, what will you be looking to as these revelations come public? And also within this relationship, the way these attempted targeting killings play into it?
So there's two parts of that question. I think one is, so does exposing this, does the fact that India really screwed up here, got caught trying to carry out an assassination in the United States and was exposed by this, will this prompt kind of a retreat on their part? Will they peel back? Will they rethink how aggressive they've become operationally in going after Sikh communities in the United States and Canada and other places? It's hard to know. I mean, I can't imagine that they would be eager to try to carry out another hit in a Western country. But one of the things we've learned from this case was that they had a list. They had a list that was perhaps 7 or 8 deep of others that they were hoping to kill once they took care of Panoon. The other thing is just sort of, how does India resolve this in its relationship with the United States? I think everybody we talk to believes they're going to have to sacrifice somebody. They're going to have to...
Like someone has to take the fall.
Yeah, somebody has to take the fall in some way. Perhaps that ends up being the former head of their intelligence service who has already stepped down from his job. But there's reasons to think they might hesitate to do that. You know, the thing to remember here is that Modi and his government, they feel like they have the leverage in this relationship with the United States. You know, India maybe was treated as a second-tier country for a long time. I don't think they see themselves that way anymore, and I don't think they're interested in tolerating that kind of mindset.
Hmm. And Greg, where does this all leave people who could be on that list you mentioned, the people who could be targeted by the Modi government?
Yeah, well, I mean, so we know of many other people, many other Sikhs in the United States and Canada who privately have been given warnings by the FBI or by Canadian authorities. Look, you might be targeted. You might be in danger. You should know. You should be careful. One of the bigger issues here is that when you look at this and you step back, you see India, which now is the world's most populous country, the world's largest democracy, engaging in conduct that we in the West normally associate with the world's sort of most repressive regimes, Russia, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia. India's decision, apparent decision in this case, to pursue actions that are associated with those kind of autocratic, authoritarian governments is really troubling. But it's in reality, it's part of a broader trend. Authoritarianism, autocracy, nationalism, these are trend lines that are rising in many places around the world, including, some might argue, in the United States. And what these political developments bring with them is more behavior like this, less tolerance for dissent, greater willingness to use the tools and levers of power of countries to pursue adversaries, to silence critics. And this is happening in many, many places. And so this case spotlights a really important thing that's happening elsewhere in the world.
And it also makes me think about how to governments like this, these dissidents, from their perspective, pose just as much, if not maybe more of a threat when they're abroad than when they're in their own home country.
Right. And there are other compounding factors that help to explain that. So it used to be dissident or diaspora populations were out of sight, out of mind. You know, they were abroad. They were far away. What was happening there didn't matter so much to the governments that they had fled. But now, because of social media and spyware, you know, these activist populations in Vancouver, Canada, can continue to agitate and continue to attract the attention of governments half a world away, like in India. And there's an enormous challenge for countries that have refugee populations or exile populations in trying to protect them. With more governments willing to try to silence them, pursue them, harass them, surveil them, you know, it creates a new burden for countries that are open to the arrival of exiles and dissidents and people like this, and trying to keep track of them and protect them. It's a big job.
Did I feel that I'm not safe in America? Safety is a relative term right now. I don't know how to define whether I'm safe or I'm not safe. The only thing I can vouch here is that I'm not going to stop.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining and sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Greg Miller is an investigative foreign correspondent for The Post. There are two other big stories I'm watching today. First, the judge overseeing former President Trump's hush money trial in Manhattan has found Trump in contempt for 9 violations of the court's gag order. This stems from comments Trump made about the trial in Truth Social posts and in his campaign materials. Judge Juan Merchan issued a $9,000 fine and warned Trump that if he kept violating the order, the judge would consider putting him in jail for the violations. And the second story, pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses are escalating. Now in Columbia University, students are being suspended for refusing to leave a campus encampment. Then this morning, student protesters declared that they've taken over a campus building. Meanwhile, 79 people were arrested in Austin related to protests at the University of Texas campus there on Monday. Authorities said almost all were charged with criminal trespassing. Across the country now, there have been over 1,200 arrests at these protests over the last 2 weeks. That's according to tracking by the Washington Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Emma Talkoff. It was mixed by Ted Muldoon and edited by Monica Campbell. Thanks to Peter Finn, Jerry Shee, and Ellen Nakashima. There's one other thing I wanted to call your attention to. This is something that I have found super useful in my work as I'm trying to read all of the great reporting on the Washington Post's website. When I don't have time to read something, I listen to it. Almost every article the Washington Post publishes has a little headphone icon on it. So if you just go to the top, you can click on that and you will sometimes either hear the reporter or columnist or a computer-generated voice reading the article for you. And now we are serving up those audio articles every day for you to listen to in Apple Podcasts. This feed in Apple Podcasts is a special offering for subscribers of The Washington Post. All you need to do is search for The Washington Post channel on Apple Podcasts and connect your subscriptions. And if you've not subscribed, just head to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. I'm Elahe Izadi. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from the Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow the Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.